friends. Welcome back to yet another episode of What Page Are You On? It's me, Bethany Rutter. I am not joined today by my good friend and business partner, Alice Slater, but instead I'm joined by Joanne Harris. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi there, I'm Joanne Harris. I'm the author of, lots of books, but you might remember Chocolat from years back, and the latest is A Narrow Door.
Yes.
And I'm really glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm so glad to be here. So although we will definitely talk about other moments from your career in the fullness of time, we are principally here to talk about A Narrow Door, which is currently out in paperback. So I normally delegate nutshelling plots to my colleague Alice, but in her absence, would you please be able to give our listeners a brief overview of the plot, spoiler-free, obviously?
Well, it's the third in a series of books set in St Oswald's Grammar School in Morbury, which is not entirely unlike a grammar school in which I taught for 15 years. And the hero is the elderly Latin master, Roy Straitley, who's had a lot to deal with in the past few years. He's had a number of scandals and undiscovered secrets, and this time he has the challenge of his life, because there is not only another disruption in the top echelons of the school, but there is now a headmistress who was the deputy head last year and who has introduced a lot of innovations into the school, not least girls, girls' toilets, girls' facilities, all sorts of new buildings. And Straitley is having a rough time because he's very much of the old school, who basically thinks that whiteboards were a bad idea. So he's got that to deal with. And just before term starts, he has another problem in that a bunch of his boys, his Brody boys, his favourites in his class, find what they think is human remains on the site of one of these grand new buildings. Of course, he's slightly worried that another scandal may actually topple the school, this venerable institution, which is always on the blink of economic ruin. And so he goes to the headmistress to tell her about this and to get her advice, and finds that not only isn't she surprised, but she seems to know a lot more about the body than he suspected.
Yes. And then what kind of unfolds is this kind of conversation and reminiscence between the two of them of
yes,
the
it's
last...
A dialogue.
Yeah.
It's a sort of chess match with a kind of dash of Scheherazade thrown in there, because Rebecca Buckfast, who is the head, has a great deal to do with this body on the grounds, and has an awful lot of baggage in her past that she's bringing to this new job. And so she tells her story to Straitley, knowing that the more he knows, the less he's likely to tell.
Yes.
And so it's about unravelling Buckfast and her past, and also finding out what role Straitley and Straitley's friends have to do with this old story, which is literally being dug up.
Yeah, and she is such an interesting character in herself, and I loved seeing her kind of up against this very apt opponent in the form of her colleague Roy. And it was so kind of fascinating to read a character that's like disrupting the old boys club but is not a sort of perfect girl boss feminist hero.
She's definitely not that. She's a monster in a lot of ways, but I also liked her enormously. I liked creating her, and I gave her a number of my own experiences when I was a young teacher in an all-boys school, because I thought she would know what to do with them.
Yeah, no, she is such a kind of, you know, it's interesting that you sort of mentioned Roy as the hero, because I feel like there are not many, you know, there are not many heroes in this story. Nobody really covers themselves in glory.
No, not really. But that's not the way I write. I like to write complex characters.
Yeah. And A Narrow Door is, you know, full of complex characters. It's so much about kind of memory and deception. And those are kind of two things that I would assume make plotting tightly really, really important. Do you find it a bit more of a kind of headache to write the psychological thrillers than other books? Or do you approach them in very much the same way?
I don't think I approach them very differently. I think, you know, obviously with something like this, where the impact of the book relies on carefully curated elements of tension and surprise reveals, I think, you know, obviously I have to think more about the construction. But actually all my books are effectively psychological thrillers in one way or another. I have a lot of affection for characters with a great deal of past baggage, basically. And so there's always a bit of that element in there. And because I tend to start off with the characters, and find out about them as the reader does, it's not as tricky as it sounds.
So was the starting point for this book not necessarily a desire to tell the story of this kind of historic crime and the repercussions that it had, but to investigate this character of Rebecca Buckfast?
Well, it's funny you say that, because I knew that there would be another St. Oswald's novel after Different Class. I knew there would be. I knew Buckfast would be the head, because she was just all set to be. I could tell that in the previous book she'd just been a kind of peripheral character then, but I knew that there was something about her that I wanted to bring to the fore. I didn't quite know what it was. I knew she had a story. I also knew that there would be a body discovered on the grounds. I had no idea what that would be. But I had another story kicking around, something that I'd discarded because I'd started to write it as a TV series and they'd just not gone ahead with it. And that too was a kind of story set in a grammar school with a young heroine. And I realised, kind of when I was thinking about writing A Narrow Door, I realised that that was Buckfast's bus story. So I thought, wow, OK, we're going to use this. And so I spliced this older idea into this emerging novel, which is why there is so much of Rebecca's voice in this story, because, you know, originally it would have been just her story, but it wasn't enough. I needed two people, two protagonists there, and I needed to enrich her backstory with something. So I used that. I used this story of a woman who is haunted by the disappearance of her brother from the school that she's teaching in, and her obsession to find out what happened to him. And that kind of fed nicely into the story I was telling, which is why it ended up feeling slightly supernatural in tone.
Yeah, you're right. Because for something that takes place entirely in the real world, it does have this kind of supernatural element. And part of that is it doesn't have a supernatural element, it has a kind of supernatural sense. And partly that, I thought, was to do with introducing this kind of childhood bogeyman in the form of Mr. Smallface, who I found, you know, genuinely frightening. And there are moments in the book with these kind of images, like the is it like a Commedia dell'arte mask or just a more generic theatrical mask? Yes. These kind of very haunting images. Like, how did you approach creating such a kind of raw sense of fear?
Well, I think having worked with children for a long time and having had a child of my own and having very strong memories of being a child and being an imaginative child, particularly with imaginary friends and also imaginary monsters, it was quite easy to pull Mr. Smallface out of wherever he came. And he is terrifying. He's the apotheosis of childhood fears. And because Buckfast has had a particularly tough childhood with a lot of fear, Mr. Smallface is still very real in her mind. Not only is he, in her memory, somehow responsible for what happened to her brother, but he's been following her and he's everywhere. Because one of the things that I enjoy about when I write horror is taking the mundane and making it scary. And so Mr. Smallface is basically centred around pipes and drains and toilets and plug holes. And actually, a lot of children are a bit afraid of these things. They make unexpected noises. They lead to places where we're not quite sure where they go. It's not a million miles from imagining something coming out of the drains. And so Mr. Smallface is always there. Also, of course, when I taught at Leeds Grammar School, it was an old building. It had old drains. I remember the noise the pipes used to make and the horrible sucking noises the plug holes used to make. And sometimes when I was working late in that building, it did feel haunted and it did feel unsettling being there. And so I pulled some of those memories into the book and used them.
Yeah, and I went to a sort of very old-fashioned, creaky school, and it really made me, you know, kind of nostalgic for that, you know, those weird buildings and weird creaky staircases and heavy wooden doors. And yeah, I loved the world of the school. But what you were saying about how this partly came out of a TV project that didn't end up coming to fruition, that's something that I really love about writing, you know, particularly writing fiction, is that in a way, nothing is ever truly wasted, that, one thing can sort of lead to another. And this is a whole novel that came out of a, what you thought would be a more TV kind of thing.
Absolutely. I've done it before several times. I've shelved an idea because it was incomplete or because I couldn't finish it. And then I've put it into something else to complete that. And this is what I tell people when I do teach creative writing very occasionally, or when I'm giving writing advice. Nobody should ever feel sorry for something that fails or is abandoned or is rejected, because nothing ever dies. It can come back at any time. You can reuse things. You can take the central idea, or you can take just one fragment of it, or you can sometimes reuse the whole thing. But none of it is ever wasted. And even the experience of having created it is part of your growth as a writer. And so nobody needs feel ashamed or worried that they've spent time on something that hasn't visibly come to fruition, because that's not how creating things works.
Yeah, and just the act of sort of writing something, stimulating your brain, seeing where it wants to go is always very useful. So as you said, this is part of the kind of Mulberry extended universe. Do you ever run into trouble with wanting to write something in one book and then realizing in a previous book that you've kind of done or said something that would undermine it or mean that it doesn't make sense? Or are you quite kind of on top of these things?
Oh, well, I have binders full of notes about what happened and when. And particularly with these Mulberry books, the timing of things has become increasingly complicated. And I'm not great at things like this, so I've now got files full of calendars and spreadsheets of things that happened at particular times in different places a few miles apart, so that I don't make mistakes, and hopefully I've avoided making too many. But yes, it becomes more intricate as the world is built. And I'd never, outside of Gentlemen and Players, I'd never really envisaged writing more books about St. Oswald's, but I just did because I liked being in that place. And of course, as you create these worlds, they do get bigger and more intricate, so you do have to manage them. Otherwise, 10 to 1, somebody will come and say, you can't do that because you did that then, or so-and-so wasn't teaching at that place at this time. But I like the way that it kind of nests, because these stories are all very incestuous. They all happen within a couple of miles of each other, and the cast is pretty much the same every time. And so you're learning more about the place, you're learning more about the people. Everything is expanding and becoming richer. And I like it when that happens.
Yes, and sort of peeling back these layers of, people present a face to the world, and then you get to sort of peel back the layers of what made them the person that they are, and the kind of experiences that mean that they behave in a certain way. It felt so kind of richly real that these kind of flawed characters with these, it's quite dark, in some cases very dark pasts. I loved reading. I loved it. And it felt quite kind of, I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this, but, quite in the spirit of maybe like Barbara Vine, these, stories of people whose past come back to haunt them. Did you feel like, what kind of tradition did you feel you were writing in?
I don't know, really. I mean, I did read Barbara Vine when I was younger. And I liked Donna Tartt, but I don't really, I'm not really aware of writing in any particular tradition. I just take what I need from everywhere, and because I read so widely. And of course, when I was at university, I did 2 years of psychology, and so I'm reasonably well read in that area too. And so some of that gets brought in. I just like people. I'm interested in people and what makes them who they are. And I find that the more people I meet, the more I encounter individuals who say, oh, I'm such a boring person. And then 2 minutes later, they've revealed something about themselves, which is so startlingly weird and interesting that I've just stopped believing anybody when they tell me this. Everybody has got secrets. Everybody has got something about them that makes them fascinating.
And often those things are...
Why wouldn't I write about people like this?
Yeah, because often those things are sort of unexamined, that we kind of go through the world assuming that our life has been normal. And then it's only through those kind of encounters with other people that you're forced to go, oh, actually, that was kind of weird. That was
That's
weird.
Right. Yes, we always assume that our experience is the normal one, and that everybody else is the strange, weird one, but that's quite untrue.
Yeah. So of all the people we've ever interviewed on this podcast, you have by far published the most books. They are often very different from each other. And do you kind of consider that there are key ingredients of a Joanne Harris novel?
Well, yeah, I mean, people do say they're different from each other, but I don't really see a huge amount of difference. I think publishing tends to be slightly fixated on this idea of genre and putting things into categories, and I understand why. But I've always been quite difficult to categorise, and my publishers have tried really hard. But I think that when you look at everything that I've done, there are certain things that knit the ideas together that I use. Because although, yes, something might be in an outright fantasy genre or a psychological thriller genre, there are always going to be elements of psychology, of suspense, of the investigation of communities particularly, because obviously a school, a village, an island, all these small communities under pressure, I think is one of the things that I've always written about, because I'm interested in the effect of the individual on the community. And the smaller the community, the more volatile the chemistry of the community, and the more dramatic the effect of the arrival or the departure of a single person, that the more difference a single person can make within that chemistry, which is always, it's always been an interesting thing to me. And then there's the idea of the outsider coming in, sometimes to help and sometimes to make trouble. And all of my books have got that element too. It's a very fairy tale element, actually. Most fairy tales that we know start with either somebody leaving a place or somebody arriving in a place, because actually that's where the disruption happens, and disruption lies at the heart of drama.
Yes, so true. You know, cause this is essentially about the disrupting effect of the arrival of a new headmistress on a school.
Oh, yes.
And the ripple effect of that. Because obviously, had Roy's Brodie boys found human remains under a different head, that would probably have been adequately, investigated. It would have been sort of approached in a very different way. And it's only because of the arrival of this person that it goes slightly differently.
Absolutely, yes.
No, that's really interesting. So in terms of, you said that you kind of teach creative writing infrequently, but I feel like you are sort of almost uncommonly generous with your time and your knowledge and experience of writing on Twitter in particular. So how did your kind of 10 things tweet series get started?
Well, it started because people kept asking me questions, and I realised that actually a lot of the questions were about writing and were about what I considered to be the nuts and bolts of writing. And it seemed to me that there was always more than one person who wanted to know the answer. And so rather than just answer the same question over and over again to different people, I thought, OK, I'll do a series of threads, call attention to them, and then hashtag them so that people can look them up. And I started doing these on a fairly regular basis, and people started doing requests. And I realised that, yeah, there was a need for it. And because I wasn't taught creative writing in any way, and because it took me a while to figure certain things out, I thought, if I can answer a simple question in 10 tweets and it helps X number of people, then this will be a good thing.
No, it seems like a very good thing. People, there is almost an limitless desire for this kind of information and education. Because, like you, I write novels, but I also do not have a background in creative writing.
Well,
and it does feel, I sort of feel slightly mad when I'm Googling things like how to punctuate speech properly, because was not taught. But,
I wasn't. We tend to, sometimes we are taught these things by editors and people that we work with. Sometimes we figure them out on our own. I mean, I have got a big grammar book, which I used to use a lot. Just to work out things like, should I use a colon here or a semicolon? I still have a slightly eccentric use of colons and semicolons. But, but also certain things about the creating of stories and the rhythms of stories and the things you pick up and the conclusions that you come to having read a great deal. Sometimes those things are good to be shared, because honestly, I do know some authors who go, well, why would I share my painfully acquired knowledge for free? But actually, making people better at writing, making them happier in their writing, making their writing more enriching for them as well as for other people. Everybody benefits from this.
Yeah, a rising tide lifts all ships, something like that.
Exactly.
So I feel like you are quite kind of public-spirited in lots of ways. You are currently the chair of the Society of Authors. What did you kind of go into that with, like, a particular project in mind, like a goal that you wanted to achieve? What's that been like for you?
Well, I was elected initially as a member of the management committee, and I took that because I had benefited so much from the Society of Authors over the years that I thought it was time that, you know, I did something to help them. And also I wanted to know more about how they worked, because it's a complicated organisation. And, you know, it seemed wrong that there were all sorts of fairly basic things about it that I still didn't know. And so some of that was for my own curiosity. And then I was elected as chair, and I took that because somebody had to do it. And again, I felt that it was a good thing to do, given how much the SOA had done for me. And no, I don't have an agenda. I mean, I can't direct policy on my own anyway. All I do is chair meetings and make sure that people don't flick bread pellets at each other or anything like that, and liaise with the staff. But, you know, I would like to see the SOA continue to help authors as much as possible and in as many new ways as possible, because we have all sorts of emerging concerns to do with ebooks and Amazon and internet piracy and copyright directive and all these things which 20 years ago we wouldn't have been talking about, but we are talking about all the time now, because they're things that impact on writers really hard. And writers are not great at sticking up for themselves. Somebody has to do it. And the trade union, the SOA, is absolutely the organisation with the clout to do that. And I'm glad to see it happening.
Yeah, I now feel very silly for being an author who is not a member of the Society of Authors. So that is one thing I'm going to take away from this conversation, is I will join the Society of Authors. And if anyone
it's worth doing.
If anyone
it's
is
worth
listening,
doing for the
yeah.
insurance alone, actually, and for the contract advice. I mean, I still send my contracts to the SOA, even though I trust my agent and he's very good and he looks at everything. They always find a little something
that's not quite. Not quite to your advantage.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there are just kind of ever increasing ways of screwing authors over, even in these kind of, you know, contracts produced by mainstream publishers.
Yes. Some contracts are terrible. Some of them are terribly exploitative. And also we've just done a study on this, actually, with the SOA, that there's a huge rise in publishers who are basically out to exploit authors, who are posing as traditional publishers or claiming to be hybrid publishers, but in fact what they are is print-on-demand services, what we used to call vanity publishers, trying to pull in authors who want to be traditionally published and basically taking their money. There's nothing wrong with having your book printed on demand if that's what you want, but there's a lot wrong in promising authors that you're going to get them into bookshops, get them on book tours, whereas in fact there's absolutely no way you can, because you're not the kind of publisher that bookshops stock. So yeah, we've been doing a lot on this, because I mean personally people approach me all the time going, "Oh, I've got a book deal from such and such a publisher and I'm so excited and they're only charging me 15 grand and I think, "Oh god, you know, the heart sinks, because the hopes and passions of these people are just being horribly exploited. And over lockdown, it seems to have just proliferated.
Yeah, and also kind of over lockdown, there were these increasing stories of publishers making lots and lots of money, you know, the kind of big five publishers, but yes. Then also trying to do things like split an advance into five rather yeah. than into three or four.
Yes.
So it feels like it's coming from all angles.
Absolutely, yeah. And the big publishers, the trad publishers, are not helping either. Some of their contracts are exploitative. And I know a lot of authors who have lost contracts during lockdown completely. Their book has just been pulled. And people who have just lost all their income, particularly children's authors rely on school visits. All those things were shut down. So the SOA basically gave out 1.5 million, I think, last year in emergency fund money to people who otherwise would maybe have lost their house, who were struggling so much because they'd lost all their authorly income through lockdown.
At a time when
furlough doesn't cover that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not like the publishers themselves were actually, they were not necessarily losing money across the board. So it's quite
a
frustrating dynamic to witness, you know, how...
No, actually, publishers did very well. Some publishers did better, in fact, but that was not true over the majority of authors.
Yeah, no, I have to join Society of Authors. I can't not now. It's in my interests, and it's in the interest of all authors to be in a trade union. I just think if you're sort of self-employed, it doesn't necessarily occur to you that there is a place for you.
No, that's true.
But the Society of Authors is that place if you are an author.
It is, and particularly if you're self-employed, because actually that the protection that perhaps having an agent would offer you. You can get that from the SOA without having an agent, but somebody needs to look out for your rights in a world of sharks and killer whales. Authors are just generally not treated well.
Yeah, and if even you, as someone who is has sold literally millions of copies of books, sends their contracts to the Society of Authors, that sort of, I think, says everything about the necessity for their skill set.
Well, it's a belt and braces thing.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's authors generally tend not to like to think too much about money or to ask for money. And there is a general feeling that we ought to be modest and we ought to enjoy art for art's sake. And if we get ripped off, then that's just par for the course, that we should all be doing this for love. But actually, love doesn't pay bills. It doesn't buy groceries. It doesn't feed your kids. It really doesn't compute that people in the arts, that creators, should be making all this money for other people but not getting any themselves.
Yeah, and I think there's also this kind of feeling that if you do not behave in a way that is sort of specifically grateful enough, then that is... I don't know, yeah, that they'll sort of take it all away from you if you're not bending over backwards to agree to every single term on your contract. And people, you know, authors, especially kind of currently unpublished authors, are so desperate for that recognition and validation through publishing that people are more likely to agree to stuff because they're just so grateful that someone is saying a kind of yes, even if it's not actually a yes that will benefit them.
I understand this completely. I would have been the same. You know, when I was starting off, I was just very grateful to be published. I wasn't thinking about the money. I wasn't thinking about giving up my job either. But yeah, I know how it feels to be starting off and just to be desperate to see your book on a shelf at any cost. And yeah, I understand and I feel that. And I made a lot of mistakes when I was starting off. That I shouldn't have made, but I had no knowledge and I had nobody to protect me. And, you know, if there'd been somebody to tell me, and if I had actually, you know, gone to the Society of Authors legal team for some of these things, I could have avoided myself some trouble. I just didn't feel like a proper author at the time. I just didn't feel that I was important enough to ask for help, which is, I suspect, not an uncommon way of thinking.
Yeah, because there is so much kind of gatekeeping, and that's why I think it is so cool and useful and generous for, you know, such a experienced author like you to be giving so much kind of time and energy to this kind of informal education or help or, you know, distribution of knowledge to a lot of unpublished authors. Because yeah, I just think gatekeeping in publishing is, it does not benefit, it only benefits the publisher. It doesn't benefit any other author, really.
Yeah, I think so.
It's just not in our interest.
No, it isn't.
So we've mentioned Twitter, but we've also clocked you on TikTok. What is your relationship to social media like?
Well, I quite enjoy social media. I don't do great on Facebook. I've never liked it very much, and so I don't use it much. But I like the more kind of ephemeral social media. I enjoy Twitter because it really is... a very reactive medium. And because I still have the brain of a teacher with a staff room and small snippets of time where I can just leave my work and go to the water cooler and have a quick chat with somebody and then disappear again. And to me, that's what Twitter's like. It's I need some level of human interaction during the day. I've realised that that's actually part of my process. When I was a teacher, I had human interaction all the time. I mean, I was also exhausted all the time, but it meant that I had this constant human stimulus, which energised my ideas and my interactions with people, and it made me a better teller of stories and human stories. So when I quit teaching, I had to replace it with something, and some of that was going on tour and interacting with people and seeing the world in that way, a way that I would never have done if I hadn't become a professional writer. And then during lockdown, all I had was social media. You know, I literally was at home for 2 years and I saw four people on a regular basis. That was it. Me, my husband, and my parents, who I was shielding. So that was it. And social media was a bit of a lifeline. So I see it as my water cooler. And I'm trying TikTok because it just looks fun. I don't know quite whether I understand it yet, but do you have to?
No, you just got to give it a go. You just got to see what it's like. Exactly. See what's out there. So we know that you need your water cooler moments, and you have mentioned often on Twitter and in interviews about your shed.
Yes.
How do you write books? I guess the shed and the water cooler are parts of that, but I would love to hear more about how Joanne Harris' book gets written.
Well, the shed is portable, theoretically anyway. During lockdown it wasn't, and I was literally in the shed. But the shed is really a state of mind. And I wrote an essay on this, actually, about it's on my website, about getting into the headspace. And I'm quite good at the headspace now because I have a number of exercises which mean that I'm hopefully able to work pretty much anywhere. And some of this is having been a teacher where I just didn't have the luxury of a lot of time. And so I had to I had to just get down to, if I only had 10 minutes, then I would use the 10 minutes. So what happens generally? I mean, not all books are the same, obviously. So the method isn't always the same. It depends on the book. Some books are easier to write than others. Some books feel like a kind of linear process. And some books really do feel like Rubik's cubes, where I'm just trying to get things in place and to slot them. And I'm trying over and over again to get a proper progression and a management of the tension in the story. A Narrow Door was a bit of a Rubik's cube for a while because I had these two stories going side by side, and I knew that I needed them to fit in a way that didn't seem contrived. Usually what happens is that I will have a number of ideas rattling around in my head and not necessarily know what to do with them. And then I will start with something. And it's usually a voice or an incident, but usually it is related to a central character. And because I write in the first person so much, it's usually the voice. And I get the feeling that once I've got the person's voice, then I can start to develop their character, because I start to get an instinctive feeling of what they would do and how they would respond. I don't plot in this kind of very close structural way that certain people plot in. I mean, Sophie Hannah does very architectural plots. I don't do this because I think that, to me, a process that often relies on surprises and revelations needs to be surprising to me at some point as well. So I deliberately leave a certain amount of the plotting fluid, so that as I learn something about a character, then the reader can learn that too, and both of us will be surprised, hopefully, at the same time. In terms of my day-to-day writing, it's easy. I go into the shed. I will read aloud whatever I wrote the previous day, because reading aloud is my favourite and most efficient editing tool. It also gets me into the headspace. I will then work for as long as I've got, which could be half an hour, it could be 4 hours. After 4 hours, I'll probably start to flag, and so I'll go off and do something else. And I will do that for as many days as I'm able to. If I'm touring or travelling or doing something that's time-consuming, I will still try to write a little every day. And by that, I mean 300 words, usually. I mean, I've got myself a kind of baseline minimum of 300 words a day, which you can do anywhere. You can do in the morning in a hotel room before you leave if you want to. And it's not so much about getting words on the page. It's about keeping my mind in the right place, because everybody knows that if you leave a book for a week, it goes feral and you have to read it all over again before getting back into writing it. So there's that. And then I'll just see how it goes.
Yeah, it is so much more of a mindset thing than about sort of rituals or having a special pen or, it is so much about...
I can't really afford rituals. I never had time for them. When I was a teacher, I was teaching full-time and bringing up a small child. I hardly had time to do anything. So it was really just a question of trying to find a way of jump-starting and getting into whatever I was doing as quickly as possible.
Whatever it takes to kind of get it actually done, rather exactly. than feel like you are a writer, rather than actually doing the work of the writing.
Yeah.
So if unpublished authors take only one thing from your writing and publishing advice, is there one thing that you would like it to be?
You don't have to be published if you don't want to be. I think this is really important for people, because a lot of people love writing and they would like to share their writing and they get joy in it, and that's fine. But that doesn't make you less of a writer than somebody who does it for a living and has been published. Now, publication is something very particular. Not everybody needs it or wants it or should want the things that come with it. Sometimes I think that maybe I was happier as an amateur writer than I am as a professional one, because that comes with a lot of baggage, a lot of expectations, a lot of pressure and stress. So first of all, think about whether you really want to be published. Think of what you want to get out of being published. And if not, don't beat yourself up about it. It doesn't mean you're not a proper writer. It just means that you didn't want to go down that road.
Yeah, because, I mean, you are a writer if you write. And
absolutely.
If you write and you take joy from it, that
absolutely.
Is a wonderful thing, because so
and
much
it
of
it can be enriching, it can be joyous. You can be exceptionally good and still not be a professional writer. They are two completely different things.
And given how much of our lives are taken up with doing things we don't want to do and working in jobs that we don't necessarily like, or performing tasks that are not fun, if you have found a thing that you find fun and you find stimulating, like, that is such a win in itself.
It really is, yes. And everybody can get enrichment and joy from writing and working at their writing and improving their writing. You can take that as far as you like, and you don't necessarily have to aspire to be a professional. In the same way that, I enjoy running. I am never going to be a professional athlete. It doesn't mean to say that running doesn't do me a lot of good, that I don't really like it and the things that come with it. It wouldn't occur to me to not do it just because I wasn't going to do it for a living.
Yes, very, very true. So final question before I let you return to maybe the shed or whatever you're going to be up to today. So is there a book coming out this year that you are excited about and would like to tell me about, or a book you've read recently? Basically, I would just love to get one recommendation for something that you are excited about.
Ha. Well, I'm really excited about Kat Ward's new book, Sundial.
It's such a shame that Alice isn't with us today, because she is a long time. They did their masters together at UEA and they are old friends. So, yeah, my co-host would be screaming at this recommendation. So tell us more.
No, it's a great book. She's really come into her stride. She did very well last time with The Last House on Needless Street. And I read her first book, Raw Blood, because it was on the shortlist of a prize that I was judging. And I remember thinking, this is interesting. It's not... I don't think this author's voice is quite there yet, but I'm really going to watch what she does next. And I did. And I think with this book, with Sundial, she has really found her stride as a proper writer of really unsettling modern Gothic. It's full of misdirection. It's full of ominousness and menace and atmosphere. And I daren't even tell you more about it without giving the game away, but she's very, very good at creating a mood and exploring the dark secrets of certain characters and their backgrounds and their upbringings. I really like what she does. And so this one, I think, is spectacular.
It sounds like it could be a good companion piece for A Narrow Door. So if someone's read one of them and wants to read something in a similar vein, I haven't read Sundial, but, you know, just based on your description of it, I feel like they could be...
We're doing an event with her next week. We're doing a joint event, which is nice.
Is it open to the public? Because this podcast will go out on this Friday, so in 2 days' time. So next week will still exist when people are hearing this.
All my events are on my website at joanneharris.com and... And yes, it's a public event. I can't remember where it is now. It might be in Leeds or Manchester.
Well, if you like the sound of those two together, go to Joanne's website because you will be able to see them together next week if you live in whichever city it happens to be in that we are not quite clear on at this moment. But thank you so much for your time. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. I feel stimulated to join the Society of Authors. I feel excited to do some writing. I am so happy that I got to read A Narrow Door and talk to you about it because I loved it. It is gripping. It is thrilling. It is deeply psychological and very unsettling. So if you like the sound of any of those things, you've got to go out and get yourself a copy of A Narrow Door, which is out now in paperback. Joanne, thank you so, so much for spending time with me this morning. I've really enjoyed it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. Likewise.
Thanks so much. Bye.